Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Because we are not fools. We can't just be allowing people to come and treat us like goats, as if there is no law, as if we are not working.
Nigerian airline union workers say they plan to embark on an indefinite strike beginning Friday.
It's about our African morals, our traditions, the norms. So there is nothing like we are trying to, to dupe Ugandans about the thinking about the economic challenges and so on and so forth.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni plans to soon return the anti-homosexuality bill to Parliament for review.
He says living conditions are bad. As motorcyclists, they have taxes imposed on them by the M23.
And the resurgence of M23 rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo forces several thousand people to leave their villages. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria airline union workers say they plan to embark on an indefinite strike beginning next Friday if the government fails to meet their demands. The aim, the union representatives say, is to pressure the authorities to release the agreed-upon conditions of service. The workers contend that they have been working with an expired contract or rules under which they operate for more than 7 years. Representatives of the union groups, including the Association of Nigerian Aviation Professionals, say the recent two-day protest was a warning aimed at pressuring the authorities to meet their demands. The group says the government has yet to release the conditions of service agreed to by stakeholders to improve the living conditions of the union workers. Critics say the strike, which they call illegal, does not inspire confidence that the unions and government representatives can resolve their differences. For more about the planned strike, I reach Abdul Razak Saidu. He is the General Secretary of the Association of Nigerian Aviation Professionals.
So the warning strike is to tell the whole world, the government of the country, the National Assembly, and whoever concerned, that we are giving them another 7 days till Friday next week. If nothing positive, that is by implementing all our demand, it will be completely indefinite strike, which will cut off Nigeria from the rest of the world. And I'm saying it because we are not fools. We can't just be allowing people to come and treat us like goats, as if there is no law, as if we are not working. And without workers, without labor, there is no capital.
I understand the authorities are holding discussions and meetings with trade unions, including yours, to try to address some of your concerns. Why are you not following that process and threatening this?
Thank you. Following that process for how many years? This minister has been there now for almost 8 years now. I want you to know, and I want the whole world to know, is that apart from the aviation industry, other ministries, other parastatals, they have their governing board of directors. But the minister here refused to inaugurate them, even when the president and commander-in-chief nominated them. And this has given room for adverse pure corruption. What we are banking ourselves with is the intervention of the House Committee on Aviation and the Senate Committee on Aviation letter to the Honorable Minister to ask him to hold up, to stop all this type of nonsense that is going on. Because we have reported them. We are also waiting for the Secretary of the Government of the Federation to tell us how the Federal Executive Council were the yardstick, the due process they follow. Because they were approving that huge sums of money that we don't see the impact in the aviation industry. The employment, many things like that. So we know what we are doing. So we cannot discuss that one on Zoom. We cannot discuss that one without having something written down and we sign. Because that is how the thing was lingering on. We will go to meet them in Abuja. We will talk. There will be no agreement signed. There will be no minutes. And there is no way the ministry will be running the parastatal on day-to-day basis. There is checks and balancing through the governing board of directors. Let us ask the minister, ask the ministry, ask them, why is aviation not parastatal? All the parastatals, then they say they have an interim board. What is interim board? Interim board has no legal backing.
If you embark on this strike, you are invariably going to cripple the airline industry in Nigeria and create chaos in the economy, some people argue. How do you respond to that?
That is why a stitch in time saves nine. We gave notice. We gave gap. We gave notice. We first of all, before this one, we gave 14 days notice. They didn't do anything. They call us fools. That we are just foolish. We are foolish. We are this, we are that. We cannot do anything. We are now giving them another 7 days. They're supposed to do something before that Friday. As we have now seen that the National Assembly, they have intervened. And we have our respect for them. They have intervened. I think you get me. So we are not just like a troublemaker. We have been keeping quiet for years. That is why we say it's enough for the whole world to know what we have been keeping suffering and smiling. All our Asian workers suffering and smiling. Can you believe it? Consequential, the minimum wage that the president has signed to law, the consequential adjustment of it is they have not been paid.
Are you saying it's only the lawmakers or the House of Rep and the senators who can intervene to ensure the implementation of the condition of service, the new condition of service, before you avert the planned indefinite strike?
What I'm telling you is that those people, because we call on them, they saw it, they saw the effect of our action, they intervene as a peacemaker, as a lawmaker, as law-abiding people, as people representing the people, because House of Assembly representing the people, not those people that are now arrogant. So we have to give them the chance, the benefit of doubt, for their intervention. They have summoned the Minister of Aviation to come and explain why this thing, because it has been lingering on. We have appeared before the National Assembly with him. We challenge him.
Abdul Razak Saidu is the General Secretary of the Association of Nigerian Aviation Professionals. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar and former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi are challenging the outcome of the February 25th presidential election. This after citing voter irregularities, harassment, intimidation, and vote rigging. The Independent National Electoral Commissioner, INEC, declared former Lagos State Governor and candidate for the Governing All Progressive Congress, or APC, Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu president-elect. But both Abubakar and Obi rejected the outcome of the election, each saying they won the election. Sunday Dare is Nigeria's Minister for Youth and Sports. I sat down with him at the VOA studios here in Washington to talk about Nigeria's recent elections as well as his legacy as sports minister. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
You are leaving the sports ministry. What is the state of sports at the moment in Nigeria, as you get ready to hand over to a new administration?
Well, let me start by saying when we took over in 2019, we were very clear-headed. We started out by trying to really understand what are the things that have been the bane of our sports development in Nigeria. First, we found out that even from definition, there was a misconstruction, because sports development was seen then as episodal funding of competitions. You're going to Commonwealth, they get you money. You're going to Olympics, you get money. Just money to fund championship and competitions. But sports development is bottom-up, grassroots, school sports, schools competition, principal's club, football, and all of that. And then you find talent, you nurture them, you develop them. So we looked at grassroots sports development as one area of concentration. We look at sports infrastructure across the country. Nigeria did not have sporting infrastructure, and it starts with the big stadia and the facilities. Uyo, owned by the state government, was the one that was, you know, a semblance of, I was in Zurich, the headquarters of FIFA, and we're trying to lobby them to give us the hosting of the Women FIFA Cup. And we came so close, but at the headquarters in Zurich, they told me point blank, you don't have the facilities. And I left that there and said, okay, I'm going to concentrate on facilities. So I decided we'll face infrastructure. And then thirdly, of course, without talking about youth yet, but around sports, staff, athletes' welfare had suffered over time. And I committed to making sure that I did something in the line of athletes' welfare. So these three key areas were what we put forward. And how have we done? First, lack of funding was the elephant in the room.
Right.
I found out that over the years and over the decades, the Ministry of Sports got 25-30% of what it needed for sports development. So it's always a struggle. And that's why infrastructure were left unattended.
How did you tackle it?
Yeah, so we came up with a public-private model. We called it Adopt Initiative, in which we developed about two or three flavors. The first flavor was Adopt an Athlete. And we said, look, we need support for these athletes. And we did the Adopt an Athlete. We pitched the profiles of our athletes to organizations and individuals. At the end of it, 48 of our outlets got support on that debt. Home base got $10,000 or its equivalent. Mm-hmm. Foreign base got $20,000 or its equivalent. It's never happened before. Mm-hmm. And we saw that really help our outlets in subsequent performances they had over time. We looked at the infrastructure and we said, unless we get private money into this, we will never be able to do it. So we said, the two most iconic sporting arenas that we have is National Stadium Suru Lere, mm-hmm. and also National Stadium Abuja. Mm-hmm. We said, let's pitch. So we did a pitch. We had to defend and make a presentation. I met Dangote myself. I did a presentation myself. And he said, look, I'm going to support with a ceiling of $1 million. Mm-hmm. And we said to them, what can $1 million cover? The pitch, the digital scoreboard, and some other repairs around the stadium. That's what we did then. I met Premier Lotto. Made the same presentation. It took a while. And he's like, look, I'm going to put down $450 million to do three priority things. We had a checklist. And he says, I'll do the stadium. I'll do the football pitch. I'll do the track. I'll do the digital board. We've completed Abuja. The one in Suru Lere is 40%, is 80% ready. The three aspects are 80% ready. Don't forget, and I keep saying it, Suru Lere was built in 1972. It's 51 years old.
Right.
Left abandoned, unmaintained for 20 years. Left to the vagaries of weather. Left to people who came in, who took away virtually anything valuable within that premises. We came in and said, we will start a process of restoration. Mm-hmm. That process of restoration is a journey. But we achieved that. We have set that process in place. We have set clear markers. We have produced a document that can, a policy that can drive it.
What would you say is the legacy of Sunday Dare as Sports Minister of Nigeria?
First, a legacy of trying to bring back and reform the infrastructure that have been left abandoned for years. Because sports development is about infrastructural rationalization. We watch matches played in Wembley, we're excited about it. We watch the Real Madrid, we're excited about it. You need the infrastructure, maintain and sustain. We've made a statement in trying to do something about infrastructure. That's a legacy. We also developed a private, public-private model, which we have seen help both infrastructural development and also our athletes in terms of performance. You marry those together. That is key, if that is followed through. But also we delivered for the first time a policy document that has turned sports into business into Nigeria. That is a legacy, even for the President Muhammadu Buhari government. And we've secured critical approvals that are necessary as incentives to open up the sports of the sports sector of our country.
Sunday Dare is Nigeria's Minister for Youth and Sports. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The Commonwealth Secretariat is calling for reforms to multilateral lending practices to help vulnerable countries more effectively tackle climate change. It is also proposing a change in the criteria for determining a country's eligibility for international development financing. This, as finance ministers from member countries of the Commonwealth call for systematic reform of the global financial system to enhance access to financing for developing countries. The call came during the maiden meeting of finance ministers of Commonwealth countries on the sidelines of the recent IMF and World Bank spring meetings in Washington, D.C. For more on the calls by the Commonwealth Secretariat, I reached its Secretary General Patricia Scotland via Skype. I asked her about the threats of debt and economic risk affecting climate-vulnerable developing countries. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
Tell me the rationale behind the decision of the Commonwealth to propose a change in the criterion for determining a country's eligibility for international development finance. And why do you think it's necessary for the international community to move away from relying solely on GDP, like you mentioned, as an indicator and instead adopt a more nuanced approach that considers a country's vulnerability to external shocks, such as climate-related disasters?
I think this change has come about as a result of the appreciation for the situation that our member states now find themselves in. As I said earlier, in the past, the idea was we ourselves were responsible. It was all within our own gift. We determined. We were the final arbiters. That's not the reality. We have seen, I just take, for example, my own country of birth. Dominica was seen as fiscally prudent, careful, doing well, turning from low income to middle income, and all was as it should be. Along came Tropical Storm Erica in 2015. It destroyed 95% of Dominica's GDP. It was thought that it would not have another such incident, maybe for 72 years, it's once in a lifetime. 2 years later, in 2027, Dominica was hit by Hurricane Maria. It destroyed 226% of Dominica's economy. So we went from a middle-income country to a no-income country within 6 hours. Then we were subject to COVID. Borders were closed. There was no money and our opportunity to build. After that has come the living crisis as a result of food prices. So all of these exogenous shocks are out with the control. And if you're only going to use GDP as the criterion through which countries, particularly the small, particularly the vulnerable, but also some of the big, and I mentioned Pakistan, if your GDP is the only criterion, then we are doomed to fail our member countries who are inherently vulnerable through no fault of their own. It's their geographical location. And, you know, we used to say before that these climatic incidents were acts of God. We now know that they're created as a result of acts of man. Our omissions and commissions have got our world into the situation we are now. All of us have one planet. There is nowhere else for us to go. We rely on the oceans for our air, for our food, for our livelihoods, for the air we breathe. If we are going to pollute our oceans, if we're going to devastate our land, then we as humanity are not going to survive. And if we don't understand that as a result of our acts and omissions, the world has changed, and we need to change, and we need to respond in order to be the difference we need to make, then we will fail, not just ourselves, but we will fail our children, our grandchildren, and we will fail our world. And I think it's those of us today who are in the driving seat who will be making the decisions. And so we are supporting the Bridgetown Initiative. We are supporting the call for a radical reform of the IFIs. We're calling for a fairer, more just, more equitable assessment, which really takes into account the empirical data we now have about the reality that we faced. And it's just pointless to say to people, nothing's going to change. The system, which is totally broken, isn't broken, and we will limp on as we now are. It's not working. And this world does have the capacity, when it chooses, to move swiftly and radically if it cares enough. We saw that in COVID. We've seen it on a number of different occasions. We need to do the same now. Mm. We need to say it's time for change.
Tricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth Secretariat. She spoke with me via Skype from here in Washington. A Ugandan lawmaker from the Governing National Resistance Movement, or NRM, says President Yoweri Museveni will soon return the anti-homosexuality bill to Parliament for review. Felix Adupa Ongwet says the president wants the lawmakers to consider removing the death penalty for homosexual offenses. His remarks follow a meeting between the president and parliamentarians from the NRM at the State House in the capital, Kampala. Museveni has routinely condemned homosexuality with overwhelming support from lawmakers in the Ugandan parliament. But critics say the new measure appears to be aimed at diverting attention from challenges facing the country. For more on the anti-homosexuality bill, I reach parliamentarian Felix Adupa Ongwech.
The president is expected to return the bill back to parliament within a week or two. But before that, the president is going to meet members of Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Committee, who always scrutinize all the bills that comes to parliament. The advice of the Attorney General will also be incorporated when they meet the members of Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Committee to agree on certain clauses that was in that bill. And in the learned Attorney General's wisdom, he advised the president that there are certain clauses in the bill that contravene some articles in the Constitution. One of it is separation of power between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature. You have to understand that Uganda now is not practicing death penalty. But in the bill, the maximum penalty if somebody is being found guilty of practicing homosexuality should suffer death.
What necessitated this measure in the first place? Because some people say that it has been rekindled just to distract Ugandans from the economic challenges that they face. How do you respond to that?
No, it's not only Uganda that is facing serious economic challenges. Other countries are facing economic challenges. Even the countries that we used to think they are the first world countries, they are also facing economic challenges. So it is not about economic challenges. It's about our African morals, our traditions, the norms. So there is nothing like we are trying to, you know, to dupe Ugandans about the thinking about their economic challenges and so on and so forth. No, that will be diversionary. In nature, that will be diversionary. The country is doing what they feel it is right for its own citizens. Even you, if you are a legislator and your norms and tradition say that you don't sleep with another man, neither woman sleeps with another woman, what do you say?
But do you see this measure, with the president signing this measure to make it officially a law in Uganda?
Yes, once it is returned to parliament, as I told you, the Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Committee is going to be sitting with the Office of the Attorney General, and they are going to rectify all those mistakes that were in those clauses. Actually, if the president had assented to this bill, we would have risked being struck off from the Constitutional Court, because there were certain clauses that intervened the conformity of the Constitution. So now, since there is now, we have looked into that as a very fast remedy, we need to settle all those gray areas to avoid the legal scholars, the constitutional lawyers, to cut off us of God like last time.
Yeah, some people are saying this is a rehash. This is a rehash, and that you brought back the old law and tried to fix it in order to punish those who practice or claim to advocate for LGBTQ plus issues. Is this the case?
Actually, those who are not practice and those who are promoting it, they should be having more harsh punishment than even those who are practicing. Why do you support something which is immorally bad? Why do you finance it? In fact, we are looking at the financer of such Ilias Act.
Well, Honorable Dupa, what do you say to those who are saying that there are more pressing needs of Ugandans than this LGBTQ anticipated law that parliamentarians like yourself are advocating?
What other pressing needs do we have if our children go to boarding school and come back when they are sodomized? Is that not a pressing need? As a parent, what do you do? You send your son to school and comes back with a pamper. Is that not a serious pressing need? It is one of the most serious pressing needs that Ugandans need to address as soon as possible. Other needs, economic challenges, are being addressed in one way or the other. Have you not seen now we are dealing with corruption very fast? Have you not seen ministers being sent into jail? Are we going to deal with other things and leave people who are practicing homosexuality, bringing bad behaviors into our society? And we clap our hands for them because we have pressing needs. Because we have economic challenges. Those ones who think their money is more important, they can keep their money and we keep our value as Africans. To make the matter worse, whatever they claim that they have, most of them, they got it from Africans.
Felix Adupa Ongwech is a Ugandan parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The resurgence of M23 rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo has forced several thousand people to leave their villages. Others have had to stay despite the suffering they have endured a few days after the withdrawal of the rebels. For VOA, Zanem Neti Zaidi went to some of the residents and has this report from Goma.
Zirabakurikiza Jean, a hairdresser, lives in the city of Bunagana in Ruchuru territory. He is grateful for the gradual return of peace after the area was taken over by Ugandan troops, which are parts of the forces of the East African Community. However, he deplores the fact that he no longer receives any clients because so many have been displaced by war. He says since the beginning of the displacement here, business has slowed down. Before, they had a large number of clients, ranging from 20 to 25 people. But today, they only receive 5 people per week. Since the deployment of the EAC regional force in Ruchuru and Nyiragongo territories, the security situation has started to change. The Goma-Ruchuru road, which is under the control of Kenyan forces, has been reopened. Bimenyimana Gregoire, a member of civil society, acknowledges the efforts of the regional EAC force, but deplores that some areas are still under rebel control. He says living conditions are bad. As motorcyclists, they have taxes imposed on them by the M23. They are not able to leave Ruchuru for Goma and vice versa because of activities is paralyzed. For its part, the East African Force pursues its mission of bringing peace to all areas under its control. He says he does his job as part of a professional force. He makes sure that he achieves the goals of collaborating with his colleagues in the National Army and establishing a process to support the work of humanitarian agencies. He is also working to assure the mobilization, disarmament, and integration of rebel troops back into the community. According to the UN Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, 7,000 Congolese have taken refuge in neighboring Uganda. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Neti Zaidi in Goma.
United States President Joe Biden announced that U.S. military extracted U.S. government personnel from Khartoum and suspended its operations in the country as fighting between Sudan armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces entered its ninth day. Biden said Sudan's tragic violence has already cost the lives of hundreds of innocent civilians and must stop. The statement further says the belligerent parties must implement an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, allow unhindered humanitarian access, and respect the will of the people of Sudan. For more on what the move means for Sudan and the current conflict, my colleague Nabil Biagio reached Salman Salman. She is a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association.
What this means is that the U.S. no longer sees Sudan as being safe for its government officials. Initially, the U.S. and other countries had tried to bring the two warring parties to the negotiating table and to have them agree to some sort of ceasefire. Unfortunately, after three attempted ceasefires and none holding for more than about an hour or two, the U.S. Officials probably now see that Sudan is going into a long and protracted war with more violence. I think one of the key indicators that this war is going to become more violent and not going to end before either Burhan or Hemeti defeats the other is the fact that in several interviews, you've seen the persistent, several interviews, you've seen Hemeti calling for Burhan's head and saying that the war will only end if they're able to capture Burhan and have his head. At the same time, Burhan was asked by a news reporter, by a television reporter, whether the prospect of U.S. sanctions would deter him from continued violence. And he said that he would continue to fight and that he would accept any consequences continued fighting would entail, including U.S. sanctions, and that he believes that fighting to free Sudan from the RSF was more important than any sanctions that any country could impose on Sudan.
Yes, so we're seeing more belligerence from the warring parties and not much willingness to give peace a chance, basically. And speaking of ceasefires, today, Sunday, is the end of a three-day ceasefire between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, a ceasefire that didn't seem to hold anyway. And families I speak with in Khartoum have been leaving the capital to other places, and many are leaving the country altogether. Are we entering a bloodier episode of this brutal conflict?
Oh, absolutely. You're seeing we're now entering the 10th day of this war, and reports are that 400 or more people have been killed. So you're seeing continued bloody violence. My own sources, my own family, relatives have told me that every day buses of Sudanese leave Sudan and cross the northern border through to Egypt. There are also people who are crossing the border into neighboring Chad, despite the Chad border being closed. I mean, we have reports that more than 20,000 people, Sudanese, have entered Chad. Thousands have entered Egypt, and thousands have left their homes in the center of Khartoum to safer zones of Khartoum 10, 15 miles out. So, for example, you know, we have maybe there are so many people who've left, for example, Khartoum 2 and Amarat, which is a part of the center of the fighting, to go to inhabit their relatives' houses in Omdurman, which is a district outside of the center of Khartoum. We're looking at, you know, now a situation where the fighting has escalated and continues to escalate between Burhan and Hemeti.
And what hope is there then for stopping this war?
This is a really difficult question. The international community has been putting pressure on both Burhan and Hemeti to at least create some humanitarian corridors. And even the basic, request for humanitarian corridors from Antonio Guterres of the UN, similar calls from the AU, IGAD, leaders from neighboring countries, from the Quad, from the Triad, none of these calls have been heeded or respected. So we're seeing the violence and the aggression that has just been, looks like two egos battling for victory. So we don't see, unfortunately and sadly, we don't see an end to this conflict anytime soon.
Salma Salman is a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association. She spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio from the U.S. state of Virginia. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley. That will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. But first, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Riyad Mahrez scored the hat-trick in an FA Cup semi-final since 1958 as Manchester City kept their quest for the treble on course by outclassing Sheffield United at Wembley. The Algerian opened the scoring after Daniel Jebinson fouled Bernardo Silva before taking advantage of a wide-open Sheffield United defence to score the second with a solo effort just after the hour.
Mahrez then got his third, the first in the semi-final in this competition since Alex Dawson achieved defeat for Manchester United in 1958.
Really good game. You know, we're really happy to have won here, 3-0, and to go to the final, because like the last 3 years, we came here in the semi-final and we always lost, you know. So we really wanted to make sure that today we put a good performance and we win to go to the final. And we're really happy, yeah?
Staying in England, Egyptian forward Mohamed Salah scored the winner as Liverpool won a 5-goal thriller against Nottingham Forest at Anfield to boost their hopes of claiming an unlikely Champions League place. After a drab opening half, the second half was an end-to-end classic as relegation-threatened Forest twice levelled up. Salah netted his 16th Premier League goal of the season to put Jurgen Klopp's side in pole position for a top-four finish. And now to the CAF Champions League, where Egyptian giant Al Ahly kept their chase for a record-extending 11th title alive with a 2-0 victory over Raja Club Athletic in the first leg of the CAF Champions League quarterfinal on Saturday night. Mohamed Abdullahmane and Hamdi Fati were on target in either half in Cairo to give their side an early advantage heading into next weekend's return fixture in Casablanca. In Algiers, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa laid down a marker on their ambition for a second continental title after earning a massive 4-1 away victory over Algeria's CR Belouizdad, while Simba SC of Tanzania picked a 1-0 win at home on Saturday, earning a slim advantage over defending champions Wydad Athletic Club in Dar es Salaam. Another away victory was recorded in Algeria in a North African derby as Tunisia's Ospreys drew first blood in the quarterfinal of the CAF Champions League against Algeria's JS Kabylie, winning 1-0 away from home to earn a precious first leg advantage. And now to netball. President of the Uganda Netball Federation, Sira Babirye, has been suspended from office for a period of 3 months by that country's Minister of Sports. At the center of the row are issues bordering on governance, accountability of funds, and general management of the Uganda Netball Federation. The minister's directive also placed Brigadier General Flavor Beyakwaso as the interim president of the federation, which is currently preparing the she cranes of Uganda for the Netball World Championships. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. A week ago, fierce fighting broke out in Sudan. The opposing groups were two armies. One, the National Army. The second, a paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Force. The chiefs of these two opposing armies began their trade in Darfur under the presidency of al-Bashir, where a brutal war was fought against the people that alarmed the international community. And when al-Bashir was ousted, the two men became prominent in Khartoum. They also play a role in the ousting of the civilian government with military support in Sudan. The army removed that group, and the head of the army became the chief, and the chief of the paramilitary force became his deputy. They have always worked closely, so it was a surprise to discover that they are competing with each other. Recently, it became known that the two men could not agree on the timing of the joining of the paramilitary force with the army. The head of the army wants 2 years, and that of the paramilitary wants 10 years. What is now surprising also is that these two men are really fighting a war to the finish, a zero-sum game. And both feel terrible about each other is bordering on total hatred, according to their own words. Now, it has become difficult for the international community to secure ceasefire. Condemnations have been made of the fighting, ceasefires have been called, ceasefires have been arranged, and have not been fulfilled. Even the truce that was agreed to for the Eid celebration for 3 days soon collapsed. So you have a situation where the main victims are the civilian population who are scrambling for food, for shelter, and for electricity. So this is a very terrible situation, and there seems to be no end in sight. This situation in Sudan is reminiscent of what happened in Somalia 30 years ago, following the ousting of the long-serving president in Somalia. Total chaos descended on the country. The brutal fighting in the country, the destruction, forced the international community to withdraw completely from the country. This became so bad that the former deputy foreign minister of Egypt, Boutros Boutros Ghali, lamented that the rich world was focusing its attention on the war in the Balkans, while ignoring the bitter war in a poor country. It is therefore not surprising that his first act as Secretary General was to appoint an envoy with the full support of the Security Council to offer his good offices to the leaders who are fighting in Somalia. The position of the envoy was strengthened when other representatives of the then Organization of African Unity, the League of Arab States, and the Organization of Islamic Countries joined that envoy, and they were able to start negotiations to secure the forced ceasefire and help to nurse a failed state to the present state today, with UN peacekeeping being installed. So even though today is a functioning state in Somalia, democracy has not been restored, and there are constant attack by Al-Shabaab. This would indicate that what is required now is concerted efforts to enhance the role of the Secretary General, making his good offices effective with strong Security Council support. This will give to him a tool that could enable him to do it. Of course, good offices requires that both sides accept it. And if it becomes possible, this will enable it to drastically reduce the competing initiatives for recognition as the main negotiator. Surely, the world recognizes and the party should recognize that a zero-sum game to end all fighting in the Sudan is unwarranted. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Clubbing like I just don't care. If you wanna go, call my number, maybe go together. If you wanna go, call my number, maybe go together. Mama no di, Papa no di, them a calling, them a know where we are. Mama no di, Papa no di, them a calling, them a know where we are. We are having fun all night. We are chilling, chilling, doing plenty things, yeah. Having fun all night. We are dancing, chilling, doing plenty. Yeah. If you're still at home, I'm so sorry, you don't know what you're missing. Yeah. If you know they're here, I'm so sorry, cause you're beyond.
Mama Nuti, Papa Nuti, them are calling, them are know where we are. Mama Nuti, Papa Nuti, them are calling, them are know where we are. We are having fun all night. We are chilling, chilling, doing plenty things here. Having fun all night. We are dancing, chilling, doing plenty things here. If you feeling it, why not rock the body? See, I'm here now, and we're dancing, chilling, drinking, everybody happy. Ooh, la 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 la. La 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 la. We are having fun all night. Chilling, chilling, doing plenty things, yeah. Having fun all night. We are dancing, chilling, doing plenty things, yeah. Mama Nuti, Papa Nuti, them are calling, them are know where we are. Mama Nuti, Papa Nuti, them are calling, them are know where we are.
Africa, eh? Hilo piano,
Caribbean,
na Valentino, eh? Havana of Africa, we loving everybody. When you come to Africa, feel at home, oh buddy. No matter where you're from, don't worry my friend, it's so wonderful when people meet. Viva Africa! Shake your body as a scream and shout. Life is too short. No matter where you come from, Africa is your home. Scream and shout. Come dance with me. Chesa, chesa, hey! Chesa, Mziki, chesa. Chesa, man of Africa. Chesa, 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 Baba, chesa. Chesa, chesa.
Mukunzi, Juliana Kanyomozi. Kenzo Africa, hey, Mama Africa.
Resist wanting too much. It was supposed to be fun and innocent, but they've given you green, no grass. It was supposed to be sweetness as ignorance, but you could not resist wanting too much. Down and around this town, believing books said, not reading between the lines of thinking this is real, hey, thinking this is real when you only escape. Well, escape is what you press when you're no longer satisfied. You're no longer satisfied. It was supposed to be fun and innocent, but they're giving you green or grass. It was supposed to be sweetness as ignorance. But your good address is wanting too much. Giving you green or grass was supposed to be sweetness as ignorance, but you could not resist wanting so much. It was supposed to be fun and innocent, but giving you green or grass was supposed to be sweetness as ignorance.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Beckford, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a goat that dies in the barn was never killed by hunger. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.